sea level rise and Florida. Just ahead, a sobering climate report for the Sunshine State. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now too with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, Tropical Storm Colin may be gone, but climatologists say flooding in Florida is going to be a fact of life as the oceans continue to rise. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, find out why cannabis companies around the nation are watching Florida this fall, all because of our state's Amendment 2. All of that ahead. But first this hour, Tropical Storm Colin rolled through town last night and the entire state, leaving behind flooding and power outages in his wake. Florida, of course, is ground zero for this type of storm damage during hurricane season. But it's also the state seen as the most vulnerable in the nation to flooding from the impacts of sea level rise attributed to climate change. Since 2004, retired UNF professor Alan Tilley has run a listserv curating reports about climate change and the impacts of rising oceans. And for some time now, he's been sounding the alarm, particularly here in North Florida, where he says government leaders aren't doing enough long-term planning to prepare. Quite the contrast from what we're seeing in South Florida already. Alan Tilley joins us now with more and takes your calls. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being here, Professor. And here's our question to callers. What are your questions and comments about the long-term impact of sea level rise here in Florida, the state with the most coastline in the nation, except Hawaii? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, or weigh in on our Facebook page. So our first tropical storm of the season has come and gone. Some flooding to be expected. But as I mentioned, since 2004, you've curated a listserv looking at the impacts of climate change. What prompted you to start that back over 10 years ago?
Well, I was a literature professor at the University of North Florida. And I'm also a science buff, so I've been reading about this stuff since the 80s. And I became convinced about 2003 that something needed to be done. So I asked myself what a English prof can do, and I said, well, I can read. I was having trouble getting information, good information, on the state of the climate, and I thought probably others were too. So I started the Global Warming Study Group, and people who wanted information could sign up. They still can. If you Google Global Warming Study Group at the University of North Florida, you can get to the info page, and there are archives for all that time. In the last 12 years, and I put it out about twice a week, whenever I get a page of items.
Yeah. To be clear, just so our listeners understand, you're not a climatologist.
No, I'm a journalist, if anything.
You curate the work of others who study this issue.
Yes, that's right.
And in particular, you've created this listserv for Florida, since we are a vulnerable state when it comes to sea level impact.
Well, actually, it's not very local. I've got people in Bulgaria and China and Poland, and I mean, they're really all over the place. And so I have to sort of steer away from merely local conditions. But the fact is, sea level rise is of concern.
To the
maybe
world.
Not to Bulgaria, but it is to Mexico. And
any country with coastal communities.
Yes, that's right.
But when you look at Florida in particular, NOAA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the North Florida Regional Planning Council, those are some local and statewide and federal groups that have started looking at projected sea level impacts in Florida. In Miami-Dade, we're already seeing regular flooding, and the mayors of those municipalities down south have already begun mitigation efforts and long-term planning efforts.
Yeah.
So as we look at a sea level impact over the next century of up to possibly 6 feet is the worst-case scenario.
Not anymore, Melissa.
Oh, that's no longer the worst case?
No, I have some news for you.
Go ahead.
Okay, this was April the 11th. And Margaret Davidson, who's the senior leader on coastal inundation and resilience for NOAA. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They're the people that the Corps goes to and we all go to for the solid word on matters having to do with sea level rise. She addressed the 10,000 members of the of RIMS, which is the Risk Management Society. They were meeting in Texas, and she said that the news from the Antarctic is sort of jaw-dropping. And she said that we can now expect as much as 3 meters, that's 9.8 feet, of sea level rise by 2050 to 60. In other words, by mid-century, we're now looking at essentially 10 feet of sea level rise. That is, especially for that venue, that is the insurance industry. Those guys are the actuarial scientists, but also the policymakers. And she picked that group because they're the ones who deal with risk. Mm-hmm. We're the ones who are going to be dealing with it locally. And what we need is a vulnerability study. Now, the need is absolutely obvious. We're getting around an inch of sea level rise a year. It used to be in the last century that that was around an inch a decade. An inch a decade we can more or less adjust to as time goes on. If it's up to where it is now and where it's going, which is the average is 3 inches a year is what she's saying. Now, we're not doesn't mean we'll get 3 inches next year, but it does mean that we're going to be getting a lot more than 3 inches by 2050 and moving toward that three in the middle of that period. An inch can be a lot to deal with. There have been vulnerability studies, as you said, in South Florida. And one of those studies was done by Florida Atlantic University. It was a study completed in 2011, and it was called Our Resilient Coasts, very hopeful title. In it, they calculated the vulnerability of drainage in South Florida, beneath Okeechobee, to sea level rise. And what they found was that as little as 6 inches of sea level rise could compromise 70% of the drainage in South Florida.
Right. And in North Florida, you have also publicly stated that within 10 to 15 years, our water table will be impacted in terms of drainage, infrastructure, and more. Can you paint a picture?
When you experience sea level rise, the first thing you notice is not the water lapping at your doorstep. Although, if you're getting tidal flooding, which we are now, by the way, not just South Florida, we had it in Southside, we had it in San Marco, and that's not going away. Once you get tidal flooding, you're going to continue to get it, and you'll get more and more. And the more sea level rise, if it goes up an inch a year, 2 inches a year, so will that tidal flooding. So that's something that we're dealing with. A third of the people in Florida now have witnessed that tidal flooding, meaning that 81% of the people in Florida are now concerned about sea level rise, which is above the national average, and well, we ought to be. The thing to look for is the groundwater level, because the first thing you'll notice about sea level rise is that your drainage is in difficulty. Your water supply is in difficulty. Your sewer is in difficulty. One of the things that's happening in Miami now is when they get tidal flooding, because they haven't taken care of their septic tanks, they haven't taken care of their outdated sewer systems, as that groundwater rises, it carries sewage with it. So essentially, with their new $200 million pumps, they're pumping raw sewage into Biscayne Bay. We want to avoid that. The city of Jacksonville is spending $30 million replacing septic tanks with sewer hookups. That's exactly what we should be doing. And we should be doing that for everyone who has a septic tank that is in the flood area, which now is a lot of Jacksonville. We need to be looking at our brownfields. If we're going to submerge, we want to have a nice, clean place left under the water. And that's because I love oysters, and we cannot grow oysters or shrimp as we should be in these new, nice new wetlands we're developing if we're going to have the septic tanks and the brownfields and the sewage systems that are susceptible to this rise in sea level.
And we'll go to your calls on this in just a moment at 549-2937. Okay, if NOAA is now projecting 9 feet of
9.8.
9.8, almost 10.
Yes.
Okay, that is an incredible number for average folks to get their heads around, particularly those who don't believe what you're saying. They don't accept climate science. They don't believe sea level rise is a real threat. And they see it as a politically motivated issue. So what would you say to those listening who aren't buying this and don't believe this is going to happen?
Well, no one should believe in climate science. No one should believe at all because it's going to change off from underneath you. It isn't a matter of not believing or believing. It's a matter of what you know. Either you know something or you don't. If you know something about sea level rise, you know that it's going up. It was an inch a decade. Now it's around an inch a year. That's measurable. It's not a matter of ideology. In fact, the ideology of climate scientists is not... It's not very liberal. Jim Hansen is a lifelong conservative Republican. The forefront of planning
and
for
climate. And you're talking about the former NASA, Jim Hansen.
Yes, that's
NASA
right.
Scientist.
He's our leading climate scientist. Michael Mann was a conservative Republican in his past life. He's been radicalized a bit by all the attention. The forefront of planning for climate in this state used to be Republican. And it will be again. The mayors, the Republican mayors in South Florida now are more or less abandoning their state leadership because they're trying to deal with thing that is right there now.
It's happening now in South Florida. Here in North Florida, how do you see the response?
The response has been very weak, except in St. Augustine. St. Augustine is actually undertaking a real vulnerability study. They've done an agreement with the University of Florida, which is now in process. They'll hold their first hearings this fall, and they hope to have a vulnerability study completed by December. So that's good. And they're sort of doing that for all of us because now we'll have a barrier island. We're all barrier islands, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all of our beach communities, and St. Augustine included. We will have a barrier island beach community who are actually looking at sea level rise and its impact on infrastructure, and that's what you want to do. You want to know what it's going to do to your water supply, your power supply, your sewage, your drainage.
Okay, let's go to your calls right now for UNF's Alan Tilley as we look at the long-term issue of sea level rise in Florida. Hope you're dry where you are, and let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Speaking of St. Augustine, Jane is in St. Augustine. Hi, Jane. Thanks for holding. Good morning. You're
Hi,
on the
Melissa.
Air.
Hey. Thank you so much for having me and having this important topic on the show. I'm before local government agencies permitting development projects all the time, and I think you hit the nail on the head with this being a real ideological issue. If you, from a practical standpoint, try to raise sea level rise as one of the factors for consideration in approving of a development and you know, asking the board to exercise caution, you will literally get eye rolls from the city commissioners. So, you know, from a practical standpoint, I don't think that this is going to be an issue that the planning agencies up here in North Florida can really wrap their heads around until the market forces start to become a bigger player and the insurance companies and the banks start saying, okay, we need to pay more attention to this risk. And it becomes a financial issue instead of just a planning issue.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jane.
I agree. And I think that's why that Margaret Davidson addressed RIMS, the risk management people, essentially the insurance industry, first with this news. And the studies to back this news are not published yet. She's just coming out as their leader in this area.
But as yet, developers in this state, they're not changing their plans. Building in Miami is going gangbusters on the coast. Here in our area, we're seeing new developments go up waterfront.
Sure.
The district development on the South Bank, that's a big new one. the people behind that were asked about this, and they said they considered water rise as just one factor out of many that they were looking at when deciding to build there.
The developers, I think, will not provide the leadership in planning for sea level rise. And the reason is that their horizon is very limited. That is, they build, they sell, and they leave. And then what happens is up to somebody else. So they are going to be people whose interest lies in keeping the news quiet and in keeping us from looking at our risk. But we're at risk. We deserve to know where we're vulnerable.
And 9.8 feet by mid-century leaves, the projections I've seen, leaves a good chunk of Miami underwater.
Oh, yeah.
A good chunk of South Florida altogether.
Everything beneath Okeechobee.
It leaves in Jacksonville and surrounding communities. We're talking 20-30% of the metropolitan area.
That's right.
Flooded out. Downtown landmarks like Everbank Field, partially underwater, if
yes.
nothing is done to mitigate.
Yes.
That's the scenario.
That's right. Well, we are. There's good news, and that is the level of mitigation. The news in the first quarter of this year is that our solar installations in the United States are up over 30% from this quarter a year ago. 20% of the energy in the world is produced renewably now. 44% of the energy in the European Union is being produced as green energy. So this is really underway. There was a contract for a new commercial utility-scale solar plant in Dubai that sold. The contract was under 3 cents a kilowatt hour. So solar and wind are getting cheaper and cheaper, and that's why the profits were down 48% for ExxonMobil in the third quarter last year. It's the market forces are aiding this. Mm. And the energy transition, we have to get to renewable energy by mid-century. But we're on the way. I think that that's looking very good. Now we have to be able to do that while we're trying to handle relocation in Florida. Not just our relocation. If the water supply is compromised in South Florida, as according to their studies, it would be within the next decade, they're not going to have water. They're not going to have drainage. They're going to have to be evacuated. Where are they going to go? They're not all going to go to North Carolina in spite of what they think. many of them are going to end up in this area. And if we don't
move inland, yeah, sure.
Yeah, if okay. we don't want a whole bunch of tents, we better get busy looking at housing.
Speaking of our coastal communities, we're getting calls from out at the beaches and all over our listening area at 549-2937 as we speak with Professor Alan Tilley, retired professor at UNF, who's run a listserv curating reports about climate change since 2004. Let's go to John at the beaches now. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
That's my pleasure. And number one, I'd like to thank your guest for being on your show because it's a pretty important topic for anybody who likes being near water. I do want to make two comments, and I want to ask a question. So the first comment is, one, people are going to build wherever they can get an opportunity to build. They're not going to ask their city leaders, and they're not going to ask their government if they can build. They're going to try to build wherever they can. So they'll build in a wetland if they can get the permit to do so. Number two, we have lots of different types of construction going on in Florida, but one of the problems that we've had in Florida over the past 15, 20 years is with fuel tank systems or in-ground systems. One of the comments your guest had talked about was sewage, but we also have in-ground facilities for holding fuel storage,
right.
which is poisonous to our environment. So my question is, how do we get our leaders, not just locally, but nationally as well as statewide, when we have businesses who are willing to toxify our environment, knowing full well we're going to be under 10 feet of additional water potentially in the next 20, 30 years, and that's a relatively conservative risk estimate.
Yes, it is.
I know climate science is saying that it could be much, much worse, but they want to go with something that is more palatable to the nation. So I'm going to take my responses off the air, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks, John. That's an excellent point. We have dead gas stations all over the place. Well, I've seen a map. That is, the city is aware of this, and These need to be cleaned up before they submerge. If we have that rotten gas in those old tanks, and some have already pumped it, but many have not, and if we have that rotten gas bubbling up over time, we are going to be having a toxic toxic pool out there. But we can clean it up.
Right. But when you talk about all these tentacles to this, people have a picture in their mind of rising waters, but there are an incredible array of ramifications to that.
Oh, yeah.
Disease is another one.
You bet. That's true. You think about that raw sewage in Miami. I'm surprised they're not seeing health effects from that already.
Okay, let's go to some more of your calls. We'll get to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments in a moment. It's 549-2937. Paul in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. We need to treat this as an emergency. We need to put out public notices that we have to take all unessential spending for highways we don't need, for the sports stadiums we don't need. We scrap the Mars program. And we start building dikes. In the Netherlands, according to Wikipedia, they were in full-scale building mode of dikes to preserve their property for use to grow crops. And as you said, 81% of Floridians live within a flood zone if the sea rise is 10 feet. And where are they going to go? We're talking, 15 million people? They're not going to move into the interior of Florida.
Yeah.
Because people in the middle of Florida are not interested in selling their lands. We have to pour all the money that we don't need, that is non-essential spending, into building dikes and protecting, Florida. The other states along the East Coast are going to have to do similar projects. And it's going to take years to do that, so we need to get started right away. That would be my recommendation.
Thank you, Paul. And by the way, here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page from John. Jack's Beach is about to start a $32 million project with FDOT for flooding on A1A next summer and beach renourishment. So it's not as though there's no one in the state of Florida in an official government capacity looking at this, but what about that caller's comments, Professor, because at the state level, the governor, climate scientists have met with him repeatedly, but Governor Scott, not a believer, it seems, in this as a long-term threat to the state.
No, he's much more an ignorer or an active discourager of this discussion. But I'm the caller, gosh, that's right. And Holland is a great example of positive planning and risk assessment and positive action. Unfortunately here, because we have this limestone base, if you build seawalls, it'll just bubble up through on the other side. I don't think there are any places in Florida that we can actually get away with dikes. One nice thing about this area is we do have some high ground. If you go up to Fort Caroline and draw a line down to Palatka, and you look at the elevation, we've got this long island of 40 to 75 feet, which is pretty good elevation, that runs all the way down there. It used to be, 11,000 years ago, it was an island in this long bay that was the St. John's River. Well, that's where we're headed eventually. Also, if you go and you on I-10 and you come to 295 and you look to the west, you'll see that land going up. That's the Central Plateau. That goes up 75 to 100 feet. That goes all the way down the state. There's a lot of land there, and probably the best use of that land is not just going to be tree farms. That we'll be using that land. So we need plans for development. We need plans for relocation. We need to look at the relocation that we can afford to give to some of the 6 million people in South Florida and other places. I wish we could imitate Holland that well, but I think that we're going to have to come up with our own plans.
Now, JEA has said in their current budget they are doing a study on how sea level changes could affect our water supply system. North Florida TPO is factoring sea level rise into its long-range plan. The Northeast Florida Regional Planning Council has been talking about this for years. But yeah, so there are agencies moving on this, but what you're talking about is a much wider, larger scale plan for relocating hundreds of thousands of people.
Uh-huh.
And it seems as though human nature is such that we don't move on something until it's an immediate crisis right in our face.
Well, here it is.
But, you know, what's the worst case scenario that you envision if the state doesn't get more serious about these types of long range contingency plans?
Well, let me say first that I was on the North Florida Regional Council's study on sea level rise from the beginning. And we came out with a plan that would have led to vulnerability studies in all the communities. We had initial meetings with all the communities in this region. And then the council, there is a plan that you can still find that would have, I think, helped us a lot. Maybe we can go back to that, but it's not active right now. I was on a JCCI study on the carbon pollution, but they managed to do that without dealing with carbon. We, the people, 40 of us on that study, insisted on talking about it. We did, but JCCI avoided doing much with that. We didn't. We in this region, we haven't even done a carbon footprint yet. That's the first thing you do, to see where you're emitting and then where what you can do about it. The absolute worst-case scenario is that we're a failed state. We don't want that. We don't have to do that. You know, we can be better than that. And St. Augustine is showing us that it's possible for a community to actually squarely face this and see what we're going to be able to do.
Here's a couple of emails. Rob emails the show. 2 points. Until our government leaders begin to lead on this issue and stop calling sea level rise nuisance flooding, we can't prepare for this. We can't just build a wall. Florida has a karst geography where the water will bubble up from the ground like Miami. You already pointed that out, Professor. And here is another email. This one is from someone in Murray Hill. Our house is going solar. It will be more expensive, but we think it's the right thing to do. If we don't address this issue as a community, we will be doing a great disservice to future generations. Okay, let's go to a few more of your calls. As we pick up with Matt in downtown Jacksonville. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Melissa. This is Matt Killen. Thanks for having me. I wanted to say, from a PR perspective, talking about this to Republicans would be best if you talked about it in a way of personal responsibility. If you talked about it like you don't want to jog in an area where the air is so polluted that it doesn't feel good to jog there. You got to go out to trails just to go get some exercise. You know, things of that nature, cleaning up your neighborhood, personal responsibility. These are things that echo with Republicans who, let's face it, are in charge and don't believe in the science. So I think that framing it in a way that they can understand is something that's going to be essential to us getting this point across. And thanks. I just wanted to say that.
I appreciate that. And it is really difficult to know how to treat this. You can just go out and scare the heck out of people, but that's not going to be very useful, probably. And it's just that it's gotten so that, so I was thinking about what I'm going to do this morning. This is not good news from NOAA. And
by the way, Paul just tweeted the show. What is the URL to the NOAA report that you just mentioned?
The
people would like to read that.
There is no NOAA report. The story itself was carried in the Insurance Journal. So if you Google Insurance Journal RIMS 2016.
And RIMS is Risk Management
Society. RIMS 2016, sea level rise. You'll get their story, and that came out, I think, April the 11th.
Okay. Roger in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Roger.
Yes. 10 years ago, I started with a few other people in St. Augustine to warn about this issue. We brought it before the governor. We brought it before the water management people, who are really the people that ought to be leading the fight on this. And nothing has been done so far at all. The example of the Dutch has been brought up before. They are certainly way ahead of our efforts. I don't understand why we cannot get elected officials to start to pay attention to this. We have got to get a governor elected that actually takes this up as a primary issue. And everybody here hearing about this issue should be planning to elect a governor and senators to make a effort to get water as their primary issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Let's take at least one more call. It's Kevin in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi, Melissa. I'm a coastal and oceanographic engineer with graduate degrees in that and about 30 years of practice in the field. And I want to say I definitely agree with the need to plan for sea level rise, but the magnitude of change that has been bantered about, you know, just aren't right. And they're kind of scaring people and setting us back. That is, the idea of a 10-foot sea level rise in the next 20 to 30 years just is not supported by the scientific community. Sea level has been rising for the last 15,000 years, and the rate has been constant in the last 2,000 years in our area of about 10 inches per century, that is, per 100 years. The International Panel on Climate Change, which is recognized as probably the most renowned study on probable sea level rise, suggests that the increase in sea level rise may be about 50% over the next 50 to 100 years. So we may see on the order of, you know, 1.5 to perhaps 3 feet of sea level rise in the next 100 years.
Right, and that's on the that's on the more conservative end of the projections.
That's
Kevin.
The IPCC.
Yeah. Thank you,
2013.
Kevin. Thanks, Kevin. Okay, well, what about that? Because there's a range of projections here, and you're talking about the far more serious projections, the ones that the NOAA official just made to the insurance industry.
One of the things that the NOAA leader observed to the insurance industry is that the IPCC report was based on data that were about 10 years old, that this is moving very quickly. It just simly is not the case. And you can go to the tidal gauge for this area. You can see the NOAA record on the interannual variation.
And NOAA is getting more serious about these projections, mainly due to the rapid melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet, correct?
That's right. And at that point, the people who were professionals in this area were saying, well, she's talking about data that haven't been released. It didn't look that bad to me. And what's happened just in the last few days is that a paper was published in the Geophysical Research Letters, and the paper's called The Four-Decade Record of Pervasive Grounding Line Retreat Along the Bellingshausen Margin of West Antarctica. It has been the case that we were worried mostly about the Pine Island Glacier and Thwaites Glacier in the West Antarctic. The West Antarctic is a peninsula, and it's less stable than the East Antarctic, which we used to believe was stable. Now we're finding that that's not as stable as we thought. But what this paper does is to document that not only is the Amundsen Sea area of the Pine Island and Thwaites Glacier unstable, but other areas are unstable as well, Bellingshausen and others. And that the situation is much more disrupted already. We found out about a year ago that Pine Island had crossed a tipping point, that it was, in fact, going to fall apart. We don't know when. We're finding out now that other areas, this drowning line retreat, is the implication of that is that at some point those with a 65% retreat, those glaciers themselves are going to be unstable. That's an indication of the data that she's talking about when she makes this, what I agree with the guy, sounds outrageous. I had to double check, but the venue that she's using is so impressive. Her position is impressive. If you look up NOAA's bio on her, they made this position for her because this is her. This is her baby.
We'll continue to follow this, but in the meantime, as I said at the top of the hour, you've curated a listserv since 2004. For anyone that wants to research this topic, how can people find that online?
Go to UNF Lists, Google UNF Lists, GWSG Info, and it's the GWSG Info page. Anybody can sign up. As I say, I put them out about twice a week, and it has one page. It's not, I don't do introductory stuff, and you need to read a book like, Well, it's a good book.
That's okay.
The Discovery of Global Warming by Spencer Wirt is a good introductory book, but you can sign up for this thing, and you'll get what I can find.
All right. Well, a timely discussion, and we appreciate you being on the program. Thanks for being here.
Sure.
Retired Professor Alan Tilley of UNF. And coming up, a closer look at Amendment 2, an initiative on the ballot this fall that has some companies seeing dollar signs. We'll explain next.
Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
Hi, I'm Nancy Bronner of the One Jacks Institute.
And I'm Kyle Reese of Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church.
Join us for WJCT's quarterly program, Faith Matters.
On each installment, we'll explore today's most pressing issues through the lens of faith.
That's Faith Matters, Thursday morning at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
You might think it's just a hat, but the 10-gallon Classic is actually a lifesaver.
The Western hat has saved this company's butt more than once.
Yeehaw! I'm Kai Rizdahl. How Stetson lasted 150 years. That, the numbers from Wall Street, and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, marijuana legalization has been growing like a weed for the past two decades, but 2016 could prove to be its most monumental year yet. Although marijuana has gained 24 state approvals for medicinal use and four states have legalized it for recreational use, we could see up to 12 more states vote to legalize this drug in November. One of them is Florida. The state's medical marijuana initiative, known as Amendment 2, will be on the ballot once again. Now, if this amendment passes, marijuana use under the law would be limited to debilitating medical conditions as defined by a physician. Amendment 2 failed in 2014 by about 2% of the 60% of votes required to pass. As all this plays out, companies that cultivate cannabis for medical use are eyeing Florida and its vote closely. One of them is the California-based TerraTech firm. Derek Peterson is president and CEO of TerraTech, and he's on the line now. Thanks for being with us.
Melissa, thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
And to our callers, give us a call with your thoughts about Amendment 2 in Florida on the ballot again this November, 549-2937. So, of course, as I mentioned, Derek, a couple of years ago, this amendment narrowly failed in Florida. Activists have been successful on getting it on the ballot once again. In a moment, I'd want to get your thoughts about that legislation. But first, tell us a little bit about your company.
We're kind of a fully integrated agricultural company that specializes in cannabis. We grow traditional produce up in the Northeast called Edible Garden. We sell butterhead lettuce, moisture herbs, and leafy greens and that type of thing. In addition to that, we operate four retail dispensaries in the Nevada arena, three of them in Las Vegas, as well as a large-scale cultivation facility. And in California, Northern California and Oakland, we operate a medical cannabis dispensary, a fully integrated cultivation facility and an extraction facility where we make oils and those types of consumable products that a lot of people are utilizing for cannabis these days.
And it's expected, given that this amendment will be on the ballot in November in statewide voter population, that it's more likely to pass in Florida this time around. How do you see the market for medical marijuana if this amendment passes here in Florida?
I mean, Florida is a giant population, right? I mean, you think we're around 20 million or so, somewhere in that ballpark. So it's a gigantic economic factor from a job creation standpoint, from a tax collection standpoint. You know, you back up a few years ago, and we didn't have really many data points because this industry was so embedded in the black market. Now that we've got Washington and Colorado and places that have really organized medical and recreational programs, we can now see the tax dollar collection that takes place. We can see the economic benefit, that multiplier effect, meaning every dollar that's spent in medical cannabis in the state or recreational cannabis, that dollar gets recycled to local businesses, restaurants, gas stations, et cetera, and so forth. So these numbers are staggering in the tax collection benefits and the economic benefit from a social standpoint. It's becoming a hard thing for people to deny now that, like I said, we have factual data points that are coming out showing the economic impact that this industry is having from a national scope and perspective.
What are some of the barriers, though, when it comes to this as a business undertaking? At the federal level, cannabis is still a Schedule I drug, right? There are still a lot of barriers at the federal level.
Yeah, there's always been a dichotomy between state and federal law that we've all been operating in. And you know, the Obama administration and Holder, Eric Holder at the time, have come out and said we're going to leave it up to the states and we're not going to be bothering people as long as they're operating under state regulation. So, you know, certainly arrests are still happening, closures are still happening, but that's only for people that are deviating at this point from state regulations. And now you're seeing multiple states come up with regulations so that they can have two things. They can have an existing legislative framework for people to operate within, but it gives them the ability to create a tax on the industry as well. So now they can have a regulated taxing system to collect tax dollars and decide how those tax dollars are going to be distributed throughout the community. So you're seeing a lot of regulation. This year's a tipping point. Like you said, we can have up to 12 states. This is the year we see well over half the country. Right now we have 24 states in D.C. with some measure of regulation. This is the year we have well over half the country, and with Florida being a major tipping point, well over half the population, which is even more important.
And Florida's interesting as well in your sphere because there are a lot of retirees here who are interested in cannabis as medicine, correct?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the aged population, you know, with the snowbirds and whatnot coming down to Florida, I think, you know, of the 20 or so million residents that reside in Florida, about 20% of them are over the age of 60. And people over the age of 60 are looking for alternative treatments to treat pain versus painkillers and opiates and that type of thing. And a lot of that just has to do with the addiction rates and the overdose rates. If you look at your traditional opiates or painkillers, you've got 2 million Americans on an annual basis that suffer from addiction for prescription drugs. That equates to about 1 in 4 people that take long-term painkillers. Those are staggering numbers. You had 15, 16,000 people last year that overdosed from abusing painkillers. You had zero from the utilization of medical cannabis. You had more people dying from slipping in the bathtub and bee stings than you had from utilization of medical cannabis. So seniors get that, and they're looking at this for an alternative treatment for painkillers because the side effects are non-existent versus, you know, like I said, the traditional painkillers that are really affecting our society from an addiction standpoint.
So as you wait to see how these 12 states vote, what's your long-range business plan? You have to sort of wait and see the lay of the land, but how does a company like yours plan for that? Because you don't know yet how the states are going to go.
Yeah, that's a great question. We always look at legislation backwards because responsible legislation equals responsible business. We can't work in a framework where the legislation is so restrictive that the economics don't make sense. And New York is a great example of that. They recently passed regulation, but they don't allow the sale of raw flour. It's only for extracted oil. So essentially the legislation that exists in that marketplace allows for the continued existence of the black market. So established businesses that have infrastructure, that pay fair wages, that pay benefits, that pay taxes, can't compete with the black market for obvious reasons. So the legislation, when it's adapted, needs to be such that it does two things. It services patients, providing an alternative to traditional painkillers and other medicines, number one. Number two, it has some semblance of a tax and regulation scheme associated with it. But number three, most importantly, from an economic standpoint, it's built and adapted in a manner where it pushes the black market out. So you have economic stimulation, you have patients getting access to the medicine that they need, but it has the ability to also shut down the black market, which allows us to tax and regulate and collect the full value of the industry to bring that money into the economic coffers to fund programs. And Colorado, again, is a great example of that, because a lot of that money that's been collected has gone straight and directly to the underfunded school systems, which seems to be an issue from a national perspective. So that's how we approach things: legislation backwards, and we make the decision based on the economic or the entrepreneurial friendliness of the actual law.
When people see the revenue potential, do you find that in the end that's the winning argument? If they see that revenue not only helping people who are sick, but going into taxpayer coffers for things like public education?
Yeah, I think that's a significant motivating factor for constituents. I mean, a lot of it is patients needing access or wanting access, and the other half of it is the economic stimulation. I think those two things coupled together are the biggest drivers. And you're looking at the national polling right now, and it's well over 50% of the population wants the tax and regulated scheme. And now constituents who are generally reactive in nature, right? No, most your policymakers don't want to step out without understanding what their constituents want. And now that we've had a few years to understand what voters want, now we're seeing legislators begin to adapt to that. We've had a gigantic paradigm shift over the last few years. I mean, we've still been dealing with the reputational hangover from the Reagan era kind of, this is your brain on drugs scare tactics, which works for a lot of drugs, right? I mean, heroin and those types of things that, deserve that type of categorization, but cannabis certainly does not. But we're seeing, again, a pretty drastic paradigm shift from a reputational standpoint for cannabis, and that's, economic-related, and that's efficacy-related is the prime motivating factors.
Finally, as you said, there's been a paradigm shift on this issue, but it seems that every time society takes a big step forward, there's also a backlash. Do you anticipate a backlash at the polls in November over this?
No, I don't. I mean, we have a lot of stuff going on. We've got California with recreational legalization. We've got Nevada with recreational legalization. Those are two major states. Economically, California is a juggernaut in and of itself, but Florida's, has a huge, substantial population. So I don't see any backlash. I do see the people that aren't supportive of progression in this space, obviously getting aggressive. It happened the last cycle, but it was really funded by Sheldon Adelson for different reasons than the cannabis legalization alone. In Florida's a unique state. They needed 60% for a constitutional amendment passed, and I think it was about 58 or 58.5% of the vote went towards a vote yes. So that's the important thing to think here is the majority of the population in Florida still wanted it. It was just the fact that it needed 60% from a constitutional amendment standpoint to pass. So it came close in and of itself. And I think this year we're going to see, again, a drastic tipping point from a nationwide standpoint. But I'd be very, very surprised if we walked out of Florida without the program passing.
We'll have to see. But in the meantime, thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having us, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Derek Peterson is president and CEO of TerraTech, a medical cannabis company. And that amendment, too, is on the ballot in November. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show. Video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. Segments up there every day. Next on Diane Rehm, Fed Chair Janet Yellen speaks following a weak jobs report for May. An update on the state of the U.S. economy, a look at interest rates, employment, and prospects for wage growth. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.